The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Well, hello there. This is Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 15 years. Thank you, Carter Glass. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. Well, as we return to the March 2022 edition of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina, we find that the music channel on the board here is not working properly, and there's only right channel, so it's probably very low volume, or it's only coming out of one speaker, depending on how you're listening to this. Hopefully that will be resolved tonight, so it won't happen to other programs. Sorry about that. We are going to turn to an article entitled Homeward Bound by Mark Kemp. The map shop wasn't just a shop with maps. It was a Charlotte landmark, a landmark on a map stuffed on a shelf that sat inside the map shop. The first time I saw the map shop in 2002, I was cruising along South King's Drive toward East Moorhead Street in Charlotte. I just moved back to North Carolina from New York City and didn't yet have my bearings. I was lost. Growing up in Asheboro, I drove to Charlotte many times, and the city always seemed strange and foreign, even harder to navigate than New York or Los Angeles. The layout of Charlotte's streets make no sense. You can be at the corner of Sharon Road and Sharon View Road, driving toward Sharon Amity Road, and wondering who in the world Sharon is. You can finish 18 holes at the Harry L. Jones Senior Golf Course on Tavola Road, drive over to the Foxcroft Wine Shop on Fairview Road, pick up your kids on Providence Day School and Sardis Road, take them over to Rama Road Elementary on Rama Road, and then to Idlewild Elementary on Idlewild Road, and be on the same strip of pavement the entire 12 miles. One road. Multiple names, one name, multiple roads. That's Charlotte. To get around the Queen City in the pre-GPS era, you needed a map. When I lived in New York, I always kept a subway map stuffed into my back pocket in case I got lost exploring Upper Manhattan or Coney Island in South Brooklyn. And during my time in Los Angeles in the early 90s, my trusty Thomas Guide, the big fat, ubiquitous, spiral-bound set of maps of the entire L.A. region that sat dog-eared on the back seat of every car in the city, was my Bible. So when I spotted the map shop, perched above the intersection of Moorhead and Kings, I took a hard left and swung into the parking lot. I needed a map of Charlotte, and I needed one pronto. Mention the map shop to anyone who lived in Charlotte between 2000 and 2020, and they'll know exactly what you're talking about. At some point, everybody's passed by its navy blue awning, floor-to-ceiling windows, and big sign that shouted, "The Map Shop," as though it were trumpeting the second coming. It was impossible to miss, even for those of us who never set foot inside. "Ah, yes, the map shop," a co-worker later said to me with a knowing smile when I brought it up in conversation. "I've always meant to stop and check it out." When I walked through the map shop's doors, it was like I'd entered the Magic Kingdom. It was a playground of cartography, large and small globes in multiple colors, maps of the world in all different perspectives from the standard Mercator projection showing the typical shapes of land masses seen in most maps, to the Peters projection, which shows more accurate landmass sizes and proportions. These were maps of North Carolina and of the United States, classroom maps and custom-made maps, framed and laminated. They were nautical maps, hiking maps, sightseeing guides, travel books, and map-related gifts. And there were racks upon racks of road maps, charting areas from Charlotte to the Central Alps. The place was packed with maps, about 7,000 of them. Patrice Northrup was in her early 40s when she started working at the map shop in 1992. Back then, the store was located in a strip mall on South Boulevard and was a satellite of the map shop in Greenville, South Carolina. The job was perfect for Patrice, who had studied geography at Valparaiso University in Indiana. She and her husband Ted became fast friends with Steve and Janie Marlowe, who owned the store. When the Marlowes decided to sell the Charlotte location 3 years later, the Northrups jumped at the opportunity. Ted was finishing up his MBA at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte and had written a 30-page marketing case study on the business, showing that sales could be increased by a factor of 5, maybe even 10. So when we bought the business, he remembers, we said, well, let's just take that case study and work it. With Patrice's background in geography and art and Ted's business and tech acumen, the Northrups started doing their own cartography and in-house manufacturing of maps. They developed a website early on in 1997 to market and sell their products to customers outside the Charlotte area. But the decision would make the map shop iconic in Charlotte was based on something that every small business owner knows is key. Location, location, location. In 2000, the Northrups moved the shop into the prominent rectangular building at the corner of Moorhead Street and King's Drive. It turned out to be a really great location for us, Patrice says, with not a little bit of understatement. One of the Northrups' vendors, Tony Redono, who sold artistic maps to the map shop, had a thriving online business in which he made custom maps of people's college towns or favorite sports stadiums. When the Northrups decided to retire in 2016, Tony seemed a logical choice to carry on the torch. We really wanted the map shop to keep going, if possible, because there have been so many, many map stores all over the country that have closed, Patrice says. Besides, they really liked Tony and his wife, Katie. Tony's a real go-getter, Ted says. I mean, you meet Tony and you can just see the energy level up there. If anyone could keep the place going, they thought Tony was the guy. In a quiet business park about a 5-mile drive southwest of the spot where the map shop once stood as a beacon in Charlotte, Tony shows me around the store's new location, a 5,000-square-foot space off Clanton Road in South End. He moved the map shop here in 2020, seeking extra room to make the three-dimensional maps that came with his acquisition of Hubbard Scientific, the largest manufacturer of raised relief maps in the United States. The map shop's playground, like showroom, still exists at the front of the building, but it sits quiet today with only muted chatter coming from a row of cubicles where cartographers and online salespeople sit. When Tony and Katie relocated the business, they fully intended to keep the store's showroom open to folks who enjoy basking in the presence of 3D landscapes, who see beauty in the lines of a detailed roadmap and history in the shapes and typography on old globes. Then COVID hit, when the Rodonos closed the map shop stores to the public. We moved in July and planned to reopen the showroom when we were able, Tony says. But then our e-commerce business really spiked during shutdowns, and we had the fortunate problem of trying to keep up with online demand ever since. He leads me to a back area, where Danny Seckel, one of the shop's 12 employees, is hunched over a hot press, creating a raised relief map from a Hubbard Scientific mold. Danny's really good at honing in on the precise science of making sure this thing is the perfect temperature, Tony says. Not so hot that it expands beyond the terrain that's underneath it. Behind Tony are shelves and shelves of raised relief molds, including ones of the Great Smoky Mountains, the Blue Ridge Parkway, and places way far away from North Carolina. Tony runs his fingers across the ridges of one of the molds and becomes philosophical about why people gravitate to maps. I think to really understand the story of a place, looking at a range of historical maps will, if not necessarily give you all the answers, at least lead you to ask the right questions. The fact that maps come with the stories is one of the reasons why Tony believes that the map shop will always have a place in Charlotte, whether perched at a prominent intersection or not. People may look at their GPS apps to get from Asheville to Brevard or from Greenville to the Outer Banks, but to understand why those routes look so much different today than they did 100 years ago requires the study and appreciation of old maps. One element that I really miss about the store being open is the stories, Tony says. You never knew at any given time who was going to walk in and have a story to tell. And everybody who walks in, they have a story right off the bat, you know, probably similar to a story you had when you were first walking in. I'm lost, and I don't know how to get where I'm going. On that day back in 2002, when I first stepped into the Map Shop's previous location, someone, I don't remember who, it could have been Patrice, could have been Ted, or could have been one of the clerks, directed me to the spiral-bound Professional Driver's Street Atlas, Charlotte and Mecklenburg County. I kept it in the back seat of my VW Golf until I learned those chaotic streets by heart. I loved my Charlotte area atlas. We went all over the place together, me stopping in parking lots to thumb to the page that would lead me to McGill Rose Garden on the edge of downtown, or to the Big Rock Nature Preserve way down near the South Carolina state line. Using it reminded me of those long trips from Ashboro to Curie Beach during my childhood, watching my mom awkwardly fold a North Carolina road map into smaller squares in order to zoom in on Rockingham or Lumberton to get her bearings. My Charlotte area atlas showed my girlfriend and me how to get to the Five Points area next to Johnson C. Smith University in historic West End and up to the northeastern part of the city for events at UNC Charlotte. It showed me the way to my doctor's appointments and to dinner parties with friends. When I transitioned to GPS, life became easier, but it wasn't necessarily better. I missed my old atlas of paper maps. GPS apps with their computerized voices and demands that we must take the most practical route possible are impersonal, inflexible, cold. They lack stories. Paper maps, the kind you open up on a big atlas or spread out on a picnic table or tacked to your wall, like the North Carolina map that I have on the back of my cubicle at the office, are like friends. They work with us, not for us. They gently show us the way. Map Shop orders can be placed by phone or online. You want to call them? Write this down. 704-332-5557. Or go to mapshop.com. And now, Kings of the Road. In Statesville, couples in classic cars take their Sunday drives seriously, hopping into vintage Chevrolets and cruising along North Carolina's highways and back roads. Written by Brian Mims. The 1958 Chevy Impala struggles to start in the chilly air. It ruh-ruh-ruhs, sounding like a whining horse before whimpering to silence. Alan Banner, his hand on the giant steering wheel, again taps the gas pedal, again turns the key, and again the engine begins its neighing. "Come on," he says as the shiny white automobile rolls backward out of the garage. Beneath the hood, the flywheel spins and spins. I think I can. Until that magic moment when the engine roars to life. It's deep and guttural. When he gives it gas, it hums like a song. Alan shrugs off the car's sluggish start, chucking it up to not having driven it for a few days. "You get to know the idiosyncrasies of the car," he says. "Takes a while to warm up, but it runs good." We cruise down Old Moxville Road outside Statesville, passing rolling brown pastures and subdivisions, rolling Interstate 40 and turning east onto the old road, U.S. Highway 64, with no particular place to go. We pass modern cars with LED headlights and backup cameras. The cars we were in had an old-fashioned circular sealed beam headlamp and dashboard refreshingly free of screens and digital doodads. It has flashy fins and chrome and white wall tires. I guess maybe 9 to 10 miles per gallon. "If you're going to get a car like this," Alan says, "you don't really check the fuel mileage." Alan is 74, a retired pharmacist who's adored old cars since he was a kid. When he turned 50, after years of working marathon hours at his drugstore, he decided to ease off the gas and indulge himself in interests beyond his career. It sounded like the classic midlife crisis. He told his wife Sandra that either he could get a Harley Davidson, he could get back into flying, he'd received a private pilot's license decades ago, or he could buy an old car. "You ain't getting a Harley Davidson," Sandra told him, "and you're not going to get back into flying." Sandra took a shine to the idea of getting a classic car. "It sounded fun, and he loves old cars," she says. That's one thing that we can do together. So Alan bought a 1953 Chevrolet Bel Air and drove the heck out of it, he says. Later, he got another 53 Chevy, a 210 Club Coupe, which is similar to the Bel Air, but slightly scaled down. It's the same kind of car that he drove in high school, the same model that he had when he first started dating Sandra. Alan went on to start the Carolina Crossroads region chapter of the Vintage Chevrolet Club of America about 20 years ago. He built a garage behind his house that shelters 9 cars from the 1950s, including not only 5 Chevys, but also 2 Cadillacs and 2 Oldsmobiles. All are in pristine condition. Their paint job's sleek and unblemished. The car club has 34 couples as members. The men are quick to mention that their wives play integral roles in the group, riding shotgun on road trips to Flat Rock or Blowing Rock or up into Southern Virginia. We could just be a bunch of crusty old men who get together once a month and talk about carburetors and compare $12 trophies, he says. But our wives have brought a whole new dimension. We're just like a big family. Sandra prefers to take the slow lane, and the old cars allow for leisurely drives with dear friends. She admires the beauty and the bold designs of yesteryear's automobiles. The old cars, they just have character, she says. They have personality. One club member, 67-year-old David Pruitt, used to own a 1940 Chevrolet Master Deluxe sans air conditioning and turn signals that he put thousands of miles on while roaming North Carolina's back roads. But after about 20 years, he sold it and ended up buying a black 1986 Chevy El Camino. The El Camino, for those too young to remember, is basically a cross between a car and a pickup truck. Business in front, country in back. It's one of my all-time favorite automobiles, so when Pruitt offers to let me drive, I feel like a kid getting Dad's keys for the first time. While it's nearly 30 years younger than the Impala I've just ridden in, the interior still looks Spartan compared to cars these days. The steering wheel is hard and thin. The car makes me feel much more attuned to driving rather than being coddled by high-tech comforts. I cruise along James Sowers Road, cross Interstate 77, and turn down some neighborhood streets. Windows roll down, one arm on the wheel, I feel pretty darn cool. About once a month, Alan and the other members go rambling through the countryside for a picnic in Salisbury or a cruise through Mount Airy. They follow the slow roads, U.S. Highway 21 north to Sparta, U.S. Highway 64 up through Hidden Knight and Taylorsville, U.S. Highway 321 to Blowing Rock. Once a year, usually in summer, the group will spend 3 nights in Blowing Rock, their cars adding nostalgic steel and chrome scenery to the already picturesque mountain town. Pruitt says that these back road trips restore the symbiotic relationship between car and driver. Your senses are heightened and you feel one with the machine. You've got your windows down, you've got your vents open, and the fun thing about it is that you concentrate more on driving, he says. My most important gauge is my temperature gauge. It isn't the gas gauge. You keep an eye on the temperature. You spend more time driving and looking. On one excursion in eastern Tennessee, along a serpentine stretch of U.S. Highway 421, known as the Snake, the club's drivers got quite the workout. Many of their cars have no power steering. Alan says, and I'm going to tell you, we had people come back who were physically beat. The cars, not surprisingly, turn heads and fire up conversations. Oh, God, everywhere. Alan says, noting that small children see the wheeled beauties and just grab their mamas and point at the cars. On our jaunts today outside Statesville, people at red lights and stop signs, people in front yards and parking lots stare and smile. Alan takes me for a second spin in another car, not a Chevy, but a sky blue 1950 Cadillac Fleetwood Series 60. It's cavernous and bulbous and has a trunk spacious enough to fit 4 golf bags and maybe even the cart. We chat about classic cars movies, and I admit my affinity for Pontiacs of the 77 Smokey and the Bandit, Trans Am. Alan is partial to his 58 Impala, the kind that Terry the Toad Fields drove in American Graffiti, a movie Alan figures he watched 50 times. Quoting great lines from old movies while cruising along the open highway is one of life's greatest pleasures. He takes me on another ride, this time in a red 1963 Chevrolet Corvair convertible with a white top. The car's owner, 71-year-old Mike Parker, calls it a poor man's Corvette. Parker bought it for its sentimental value. His mom, dad, and older brother each had one. Most of the Statesville Car Club members don't fancy themselves as gearheads, folks who do all their own mechanical work. They'd rather not spend gobs of time tinkering under the hood. They prefer enjoying the beauty of the cars and the thrill of getting them out on the open road. I've always loved old cars, loved looking at them, loved reading about them, says Alan, who's also a prolific collector of car-related memorabilia. His garage walls are plastered with license plates, photos of classic automobiles, old motor oil ads, and an Al's Garage sign. Walking into the basement of his house is like stepping into a 1950s diner that doubles as a museum. It has restaurant booths, a working jukebox, pictures of Patsy Cline and Buddy Holly, lighted beer signs, and a fridge stocked with Yingling. "If you don't mind, Al, I'm going to grab a beer," Parker says, and next thing you know, everyone has a cold one in hand, talking about favorite cars and favorite places. As the jukebox plays early 50s R&B hits 60 Minute Man, it's as good time as any to think about the next road trip. To Granite Falls or Fancy Gap, Virginia. To a good place to have lunch. To a nice spot to stay for the night. It's always important to get the flywheels spinning, the crankshafts turning, and those shiny grills in the wind aiming for the horizon and taking us back. And now we have about 7 minutes left or so. I'm going to turn here to the front and read some of a shorter section. Welcome Home March, National Reading Month. Clara Craven Book Club in Garner. At any given meeting of the Clara Craven Book Club in Garner, a member might speak up and say, "I have a word." It could be a new or unusual term in the latest book that the group has been reading. It might be an unfamiliar word that someone spotted on the side of a truck or heard on the radio. At a recent gathering, the word offered by former second grade teacher Jean Tunstall was Sunduku. That's T-S-U-N-D-O-K-U. Sunduku. Or doku. Sundoku, I guess. A Japanese term that means to stack up a lot of books that you're going to read in the future. The group howled. The word was perfect. This distinguished book club, which has been meeting monthly since 1945, has always been an assembly of very bright women who are fiercely dedicated to literacy, literature, and lifelong learning. The 12 current members, like their mothers and grandmothers before them, are always finding new books to share. Their tastes range from historical novels to memoirs to science fiction. Caring for one another and seeing each other through the challenges of aging, accidents, and loss have become the bedrock for their long and sturdy friendships. The late Katie Corbett, a brilliant woman who confidently tackled the New York Times crossword puzzle with a pen every Sunday, founded the group just as World War II was coming to an end. Now her granddaughter, Kathy Blue, a retired biostatistician, is the club's historian. Blue has attended meetings since she was a grade school interloper in Neesox. Back at the beginning, she says, Garner was still a small farming and railroad town, and women were hungry for more cultural activities. The club's namesake, Clara Craven, the beloved widow of a local Methodist pastor, served as the glue in the early years. The group's reading and book swapping were shaped around such broad themes as current events, gardening, and North Carolina authors. The discussion topics deepened as their curiosity grew, and the women tackled modern art, foreign travel, contemporary architecture, and classics like Wuthering Heights. Jane Sullivan, who once had Blue as her algebra student, now handles the book choices and encourages each member to lead one discussion per year. Limiting the group size to a dozen members enhances the intimacy. With too many people, you just can't really sit down and hash out a book, Blue says. We tend to be quite verbal. With our club being made up of so many former teachers, I was nervous at first, says Martha Tippett, the current president and a relative newcomer. But it's a no-judgment zone. If you don't finish the book, that's okay. You won't get demerits. Jean Tunstall, who retired from the second grade classroom and now volunteers in literacy program for adults, affirms the power of the club. "We have seen a whole lot of life together over the years," she says. "The club has been an important enough thing that we make it work no matter what." Little sidebar here, a statewide book club. Don't you love the excitement of getting a new book? This year, Charlotte-based nonprofit North Carolina Humanities shared that sense of anticipation when it sent more than 3,200 books to groups and individuals as part of a new statewide book club, North Carolina Reads. Along with the book kits, which include discussion questions, bookmarks, and other goodies, the program hosts monthly panel events open to the public that feature the book's author and an expert on the subject matter. In conjunction with this month's book, Riley Cash's historical fiction novel, The Lost Ballad, North Carolina Reads will host a virtual panel on March 30th about the labor movement in the early 20th century. Now, if you're interested in learning more about this, please call 704-687-1520 or visit nchumanities.org. Very quickly now, the Mitford Museum in Hudford. The hallway outside Jan Karen's first grade classroom tells the story, in her own words and pictures, of how a little girl who loved drawing and writing became one of the best-selling novelists of the world. The Mitford Museum, housed in the historic Hudson School building where Karen attended elementary school while living with her grandparents from 1941 to 49, weaves its tales with the same homespun tone that made her 14-novel Mitford series enduringly popular. Take the family's battle with a giant chicken hawk, recalled with startling detail in Karen's grandmother's Fanny Clower's handwriting. With true mountain fortitude, Clower fought and defended the creature, posing for a photo taken by 8-year-old Karen after she helped wire the bird's head back on, or to show the predator's wingspan. Clower's well-loved biscuit pan in a frame nearby is yet another nod to a pivotal figure in the author's life. Writers seeking inspiration don't have to look far in this homage to the written word. A peek inside Karen's open desk drawer reveals a bow-tied manuscript of These High Green Fields, 1996, the desktop littered with hand-corrected pages. After leaving a successful career in advertising, Karen moved to Blowing Rock at age 50 to write. In her first novel, At Home in Mitford, 1994, she brought to life an unlikely set of characters: middle-aged bachelor and Episcopal priest Father Tim, his over-exuberant dog Barnabas, a mountain boy named Dooley, and an entire cast of locals. She creates a community that the reader feels pulled into, says museum's director Sarah Thomas. As Karen, now 85, puts it, the museum is my book without covers. There in Hudson, themitfordmuseum.org. And that is all the time we have for today's episode of Our State Magazine. Hope you enjoyed it, and you'll listen again next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Comments, questions, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.